Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award is one of the richest and most prestigious in its field. It comes with a prize of $100,000. And this year, the award went to someone the competition's chief judge says essentially invented himself from whole cloth as a poet. The winner is Somerville-based poet Offa Michael Weaver.
Weaver is a former Fulbright scholar and a fellow for the National Endowment for the Arts. He's currently a professor at Simmons College in Boston. He'll be appearing at the Peabody Essex Museum this coming Sunday as part of the Massachusetts Poetry Festival. With all that going on, he still made time to join us live in the studio. Offa Michael Weaver, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you here. So as that comment that Meghna read from the judges suggests, you have led a very interesting life. Let's talk a little bit about it, and then we want to hear some of your poetry. You grew up in Baltimore and still have a pretty strong affinity for the place, right?
Yes, I do.
And you started writing when you were very young. What did you write about?
It was the poetry of courtship. I wrote love poems to the young lady who would become my first wife.
They must have been good.
I suppose they were.
I think so. Your poetry also, we know, is influenced by your parents, and we should say that their parents and grandparents were sharecroppers. Your parents, though, introduced you to blues and gospel, and I wonder where gospel and blues enter into your poetry.
Well, my father had a very fluent kind of ability and language as a southerner and someone who resisted being urban. And so when he talked naturally in metaphors. He was a man who didn't finish high school. And the one time that I did hear him sing, he burst out in a blues melody, and I was really surprised.
Do you remember what it was?
Going to Chicago.
Oh,
sorry,
really?
I can't take you. Yeah.
This is a man who rejected the urban life.
Absolutely.
Still, bound for Chicago. So why don't you read for us your poem that's from the book. This is your 12th book called The Government of Nature, and this is the book that won you the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award. I wonder if you would read Passing Through Indian Territory and set it up for us. I don't know if this has kind of a gospel or blues rhythm to it. Maybe you can tell us.
Well, I wouldn't say that it was written consciously that way. It might sound that way. I was in Oklahoma at at an event for the University of Oklahoma. I had been invited to read, and there was an interview. And that's Indian territory. There are horses everywhere, statues of cowboys, and I learned quite a bit about horses when I was a child. And I was just inspired to write about the possibility of coming back home to Boston on horseback. So, passing through Indian territory. On horseback, I tell them to imagine me on horseback, going back to Boston, an oversized wool overcoat on top of layers of things that make themselves warm against me, old tops of boxes of pictures of horses pressed flat to mesh and weave like cloth. I tell them it might take me a few months to get home because I like to stop when I travel, pull over so I can rest. And what about falling asleep on the horse? What about what I did not imagine? Smokestack man slumped down, snoring in the saddle, sliding over to the edge of the grace of horses, their mercy, forgiveness, even for people who forget how the lines between territories are made of the flesh of ghosts, who had no words for where land ends or where land begins, or why there is a horse waiting for me to answer for the uncle who killed her.
When you write a poem such as that, that has a trajectory to it, do you know when you begin it where it's going to end?
In that particular instance, I don't. It was very associative. And it was published first in The New Yorker, and I had a dialogue and email with Paul Muldoon, the editor, who asked me to consider the last two lines. In that exchange with him, I discovered where the poem was going.
To consider them, meaning he proposed them?
No, he said, why don't you look at those last two lines, because I'm wondering if that's where it's going, the previous version of the poem. And I read the poem, and I thought, that's about the horse that I was given when I was a teenager in Appaloosa.
Huh. So that's interesting, kind of a behind-the-scenes look at the process as you're publishing a poem and talking through an editor at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah. So a little bit more then about the way these themes from your childhood influence your poetry. Maybe tell us a little bit more, if you will, about your childhood in Baltimore.
Well, when I was in the sixth grade, my parents came home and from a visit with the principal, and I was quite sure I'd done something terrible, but I had not. They decided they were going to put me in an advanced program, so I skipped the eighth grade. And I finished high school when I was 16. So for those 5 years, from the seventh through the 12th grade, I had an average of 3 to 4 hours of homework per night. I was the oldest child of five, and my parents couldn't help me with my homework after algebra and French. They had no knowledge of that. So I became a very independent learner. In a structured environment, of course, but I learned how to depend on myself. And that has carried me through. And so this poem is influenced by my studies in Chinese as well. I took up Chinese when I was 50 years old. And something happened to me in the course of studying Chinese that actually enhanced this associative way of writing in English.
This is when you were studying the language Mandarin.
Yes.
What happened?
Well, it's something in the process of going from one language that's 180 degrees away from the other. Chinese is actually, it feels very opposite. And in making that motion back and forth, studying, memorizing characters, I think I probably broke down a few walls in between the process there that allowed me to associate more freely.
So your studying Mandarin influenced your writing poetry in English?
Yeah, I believe it did. I really believe it did.
Let me. This is a fascinating story, but you've got an awful lot of fascinating stories. I want to go back to your college years. You didn't finish. You decided to start working in a factory.
I did. I dropped out in the spring of 1970 when then President Nixon, ordered the invasion of Cambodia, which had nothing to do with my decision. I got married and took a job in a steel factory for 1 year, but I did join the military. I volunteered for the Army Security Agency.
You're a cook.
I was a cook, yes, yep. For the American Intelligence Unit. So, but and then the following year, when I came back from basic training, I got a job at Procter & Gamble, the Baltimore plant.
So back to the factory, the steel factory, you had a nickname there. You were called the flower.
Yes,
honestly,
I was.
Looking at you, I don't see it.
A very tall flower.
What was that about?
Well, when I was, it was 1978, 79, that winter, I started studying Tai Chi Chuan, the full name. And so I practiced in the warehouse. It was a wide open space, and so I could take a single posture and practice it, and they gave me that nickname. The flower of the warehouse.
You eventually went back to school. You went to Brown University, and there you worked with a man named George Houston Bass.
Yes, George Houston Bass.
Bass, thank you. Tell us about him.
Professor Bass, who passed away, unfortunately, in 1990, was one of Langston Hughes's three secretaries at the time that he was secretary, and he was named the executor of Langston Hughes's estate. He was a poet and a playwright. He was my mentor at Brown in African-American aesthetics and black theater, and a very important influence. And he spoke to me one day in his office. He had Langston Hughes's ashes there in the office, and he explained to me what he perceived was my mission as an African-American poet.
Which was what?
He said, due to the fact of my origin, where I came from, so in terms of my socioeconomic background, my responsibility was to bring the respect of the critics to the work of ordinary people.
That's a heavy mantle.
Yeah, well, he was prone to do such things, but it made an awful lot of sense to me. I understood what he was saying as I got older.
You as you get older and receive very prestigious awards like this, you certainly keep a lot of your background with you, and I wonder if you could finish out, Professor, by reading something from an earlier collection for us. This is your 1998 book called Talisman, which is probably your most personal, and there's a great poem in that collection called Hershey's Chocolate. In the time we have left, could you read that?
Sure. Hershey's Chocolate. Some nights she would make herself a pan of pure chocolate. By herself, she would dip it out with a spoon and eat it like it was a dessert from some fine restaurant. She did it so she could enjoy herself, she said. But when I watched her, something in her made me want to cry. I knew Mama wasn't just enjoying herself. She was forgetting. It takes growing up to learn to forget, but sometimes all it takes is being a little boy.
For those who want to hear more and talk to you, you're going to be appearing at the Peabody Essex Museum this Sunday as part of the Massachusetts Poetry Festival. Folks listening can find out more on our website, radioboston.org. Afa Michael Weaver, professor at Simmons College and winner of the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award, thank you.
Thank you.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. Join us tomorrow on Radio Boston.